Our scripture reading is from 1 Samuel 25, 32 through 38. Hear the word of the Lord. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you, who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly, by morning, there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male." Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Parenting's a lot of fun. Yesterday, we went to my youngest son's first basketball game. He's a kindergartner, and he went there, and it's a little bit of chaos on the field, like on the basketball court. Like, they kind of just migrate together, and they try to steal the ball from one another, and then it's just crazy. But it's a lot of fun. And so we enjoyed watching him. But parenting is also full of tough stuff. I mean, it was that same son who, when we first moved to Idaho, was only a toddler. So our neighbor stopped by while we were in the middle of a painting project. And so I chatted with the neighbor. But I didn't see that Gideon had followed me out into the garage and actually had started testing the paint. Oh, one little test. And it was an approval. Oh, that was good. Let's do more of that. I didn't catch him, and so Elizabeth walks out and, "What are you doing?" And covered in paint. So we ended up calling the hospital and seeing if we needed to take him in, and they said he'd be fine. But at an early age, one of the primary jobs is when you have a child at an early age, is to keep them alive because they're constantly trying to kill themselves, going into the street, jumping off of things. Don't put your finger in there. Don't eat the fertilizer. Don't drink the paint. Don't jump in that river. No, don't run in the street. It's a constant battle to keep your child alive. And you're not only trying to keep them from making bad decisions, but you're also keeping them from those bad decisions' consequences. Well, our passage today is focused on how God keeps David from sin and from sin's consequences by sending his servant. If you have a copy of God's word, please turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We're going to do what we do every week as I'm going to open a passage of scripture. We're going to read through it together, and I'm going to explain it to us and apply it to our lives. One of our goals as we study the Old Testament, and really any passage of scripture, is to ask the question, how does this point to Jesus? And we ask the question, how do we get to Jesus from here? And we're going to do just that. Last week, we studied 1 Samuel 24 and watched as David entrusted God with justice and vengeance in the face of a golden opportunity to kill his oppressor, Saul. Now, chapters 24, 25, and 26 are all a unit that carries the same general plot structure. And here's the plot structure. David is in the wilderness. He has the opportunity to kill a slime bag. The slime bag is spared by David, and the slime bag receives justice from the Lord. David leaves the scene in safety. That's the general plot of 24, 25, and 26. They all carry the same plot structure. So what's the point? You'll see as we study the passage, the tension of chapter 25 surrounds the action of a fool named Nabal and the wise response of his wife named Abigail. The passage structure, not the narrative structure, but the passage structure is like this. The passage structure begins with a problem and ends with a solution. David's foolish problem in 25, 1 through 17. Abigail's peaceful plan in 18 through 31. David's blessed response in 32 through 35. And Abigail's wise solution in 36 through 44. So normally, I share the main idea of our passage right here. But what I'm going to do today is actually let the passage reveal it at the end. And so ask you throughout the passage to be looking for the main idea. What is the main idea of this passage? Because the passage is so long, I'm not going to read the whole passage today. It's 44 verses long. And so what I'm going to do is going to read it through section at a time, 1 through 17, and then we'll get to 18 through 31, and we'll kind of piece through it together. So please follow along with me as I read about David's foolish problem in verses 1 through 17. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness in Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of this man was Nabal. And the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning, beautiful. But the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, so David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you and peace be to your house and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David. And then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed from my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against us, against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him." Do you notice how the chapter begins? How does the chapter begin? Well, it begins with the death of a main character. Have you ever watched a show and like a main character dies? It's like, what gives? It's a main character. This is sad. Samuel is the main character, the man who the whole book is named after. But did you notice how briefly his death is mentioned? It's like a filler sentence. Ho-hum. oh, and Samuel died. On to other more important news. Wait, what? What? This is not a speed bump, but a massive plot twist. Samuel, the voice of God to Saul and David, is dead. And his whole obituary column is less than a verse long. What happened? Although it's brief, look at how Samuel's death is mentioned in verse 1. Now Samuel died. And all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. All of Israel, the whole nation gathers to mourn his death, and he's buried in peace in his home in Ramah. While the mention of Samuel's death is short, it's significant, because Samuel's death is going to contrast with another death in the chapter, near the end of the chapter, and which I'll talk about when we get there. Samuel's death is peaceful and mourned by the whole country. It contrasts not only with Nabal at the end of the chapter, but it will serve as a stark contrast to Saul at the end of the book. We'll get there. One death is peaceful, one death and mournful, and while the other is full of chaos and shame. And I'll kind of let that marinate, because that's an important part that we're going to discuss at the end. Let's get into the story. David and his militia of 600 men are still in the wilderness of southern Judah in an area called Maon. It's been mentioned before. But just like the beginning of any story, we're introduced to a new character in verse 2. Look at how the author describes this new character in verse 2. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now, what do we know about this guy? He's a businessman who does his business in the region of Carmel, not to be confused with Mount Carmel, which is up north. This is a different Carmel, which is in southern Judah. Now, what do we know about him? Well, right away, he's very wealthy. He's a wealthy dude. And his wealth is measured in livestock. Sheep. 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. But I want you to notice something. Is there anything mentioned, and is there anyone else mentioned in the surrounding context who has 3,000 of something? Skip back a chapter to verse 2. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goat's rocks. Okay, so maybe there's some connection here. Saul has 3,000 elite warriors with him. Interesting. But what about the second verse of the next chapter, chapter 26, verse 2? So Saul rose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with, what is it? 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David's life in the wilderness of Ziph. So, again, 3,000 elite warriors mentioned. So you have in verse 2 and chapter 24, 3,000 elite warriors. You have verse 2 in chapter 25, 3,000 sheep. And you have in chapter 26, 3,000 elite warriors again. What's the point? Well, I want you to notice something. Strangely, Saul is completely missing from chapter 25, except when you get to verse 44, the last verse. And he's kind of mentioned in passing. What's the point? Well, as 21st century American readers, we kind of want the facts to slap us in the face. Like, give us the black and white facts. You know, we want him to jump out and say, this wealthy character represents Saul. Well, Old Testament writers don't communicate that way. Very rarely do they do that. They actually parallel and contrast. They show the connection through parallels and contrasts. In this case, the author wants you and me to know that this wealthy businessman with 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats is parallel to Saul, who has 3,000 elite warriors. So this wealthy businessman is standing in the place of Saul, basically as his understudy in this episode. An understudy is someone like in a drama, like someone gets sick. Oh, understudy's in, you're in. So Nabal is standing in the place of Saul in this episode. So if you brought in a character to replace the donkey king, Saul, for an episode, what would you name him? What would represent all of Saul's life character? Someone who's rebelled from God, someone who wanders in the wilderness searching for something he can't find, something that communicates incompetence. Well, look at verse 3. Verse 3. Now, the name of this man was Nabal. His name's Nabal. Now, if you're in the you're an original reader, this is where you laugh. That's funny. Because this is intended for you to go, what? Nobody's named that way. It'd be like walking up to me walking up to you, shaking your hand and introducing myself by saying, hello, my name is Imbecile and I'm really dumb. Nabal's name means fool. So when you read of the fool in Proverbs, Nabal's name is next to the definition. David has Nabal's face on his mind when he writes the words of Psalm 53, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Everything Nabal does in this story is over the top, lavishly foolish. Nabal helps us to understand that wealth doesn't necessarily follow wisdom. Wealth came to the fool here. And remember, as we study through this passage, Nabal is standing in the place of Saul. Kind of puts a disclaimer on the health and wealth gospel, huh? The fool is wealthy. But Nabal's name is mentioned in contrast with another name in verse 3. Look back at verse 3. Now, the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. Now, Abigail's name means beloved of the father. She's described as discerning, wise, and prudent. She's beautiful. Literally, the word means beautiful of form. She's elegant. In many ways, we're going to see a narrative play out between Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly from the book of Proverbs. But look at the contrast between foolish Nabal and Abigail. Abigail is discerning and beautiful, while Nabal is harsh and badly behaved, meaning severe, cruel, stiff-necked. And he's a Calebite, someone who's descended from the faithful person Caleb. In the Exodus and the conquest, Nabal is a descendant of a godly man. Nabal reminds us that just because your dad or mom was a good Christian doesn't mean that you will be too. Young man, young lady, you must follow Jesus on your own. You cannot trust your parents to follow Jesus for you. In verse 5, we find out that it's shearing season for Nabal. This is money-making time for Nabal. Time to ring in the wealth. It's time for the Philistines. It is the time when the Philistines would want to attack to steal all the wealth of Nabal. David knows this, so David and his 600 men do what Saul, king of Israel, is supposed to be doing. What's Saul supposed to be doing? Protecting his sheep, protecting his people. But David's militia runs on its stomach. History teaches us that. You can't run an army on an empty stomach. And so After guarding Nabal's wealth, David gets 10 men together to peacefully ask Nabal for a slice of his abundance. Just one little slice of the pie. Now look at verses 6 through 9. 6 through 9. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. And we're going to actually stop there. You hear it? Peace, peace, peace. I bring peace. And you're having a feast. Can you spare a small portion to feed the ones who have helped put that feast on your table? Up until this point in the story, there's not really much tension, right? We just know that Nabal is a fool and he's harsh and not really a good dude. Abigail's there and we know the situation, but there's not really any tension, a whole lot of tension. But look at the end of verse 9. And when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David. And then they waited. Is it polite to make your hungry guests wait? Then the fool opens his mouth. Look what he says in verse 10. And Nabal answered David's servant, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their master. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed with for my shearers and give it to the men who come from I do not know where?" Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Is there anyone else asking this question in the story so far? Yeah, actually, he asked this specific question. Saul does right after David kills Goliath. Who is this kid? Who is this nobody? Now, by this time, Nabal knows exactly who David is. He's the hero of Israel, the slayer of giants. His questions are intended to be an insult to David. Who is this nobody, David and Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their master. Nabal is basically calling David a runaway slave of Saul. Now look how he finishes his response in verse 11. You heard me say it. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat? The whole thing is over the top selfish. Just like Saul, Nabal is focused entirely on himself and his resources and has no room for hospitality. Not even for the ones who have guarded his people and his sheep. Nabal is returning evil for good. Nabal is sending David and his hungry men packing. No soup for you. They go back and convey Nabal's message to David. Foolish Nabal is stingy, selfish, and void of hospitality for the hungry. So how does David respond in verse 13? And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword. Men, get your swords. We're about to give Nabal a lesson in hospitality. We're going to feed him steel." So 400 men get ready to attack Nabal, and 200 men stay to protect the camp. But I just want to stop here. Why is David so chapped? I mean, I get it. He's hungry, right? So hangry. But swords? I mean, why is David's response so severe? He did just kind of insult his dad and told him he was can he just get over an insult? What is this, junior high? We're dealing with some cultural issues here. In the honor-shame culture of the Middle East, hospitality is a matter of life and death. It still actually exists to this day. If you've read the book Lone Survivor, it actually plays a huge part of the story of Lone Survivor. As in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, one of the Navy SEALs is taken under the house of an Afghan person who commits to hospitality, to the point where he is having to battle other Afghans to keep and protect this Navy SEAL. It's a big deal, even today. So If a guest comes to your house, you're obligated to show him or her hospitality, even to the point of laying down your life to protect your guest. Now, to not provide a meal of hospitality for your guest would carry a scourge of shame that may actually last generations. Now, David and his men are presuming that Nabal will show lavish hospitality in light of the lavish protection they provided for his whole house and actually protecting his wealth. So not only has Nabal not shown hospitality to David or his men, but he has severely insulted them. Nabal has no honor. Nabal shames those who give him good. So David prepares his men to wipe the foolish shame of Nabal off the map. What a picture of the importance of hospitality. Jesus displays the opposite of Nabal, right? Nabal refuses hospitality even for those who have shown him good. While Jesus welcomes the stranger and sojourner to his table by grace through faith. In fact, the word for hospitality in the New Testament is a lover of strangers. So as you read through the New Testament, you'll find that hospitality, welcoming people to your table, is actually the primary mark, one of the primary marks of Jesus' community. In fact, hospitality is one of the first baby steps that the early church takes in Acts chapter 2. Hospitality, opening your dinner table to others. So when you evaluate your dinner table, your hospitality, does your table look more like Nabal's table or Jesus' table? Let's keep going. Nabal's foolish and shameful act of inhospitality has put his whole house in danger of death. And the tension rises as we get more details about the conversation from Nabal's young men who explains the situation to Abigail. That's interesting. Where does the young man go for safety? They go to the man of the house, the one who's supposed to be protecting his house, the man of wisdom. No, he goes to Abigail. Now look what the young man says in verses 14 through 17. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them." I'm just going to stop there. Railed is the idea of screaming at the top of your lungs. Reminds me of a drill sergeant in the military. You know, he's screaming in the face of a new recruit who has just disgraced the entire platoon of men. You can smell his breath. Feel the heat of it as it kind of hits your face. Drops of spit hit your face from his screaming. That's kind of the idea of what's happening with Nabal. Nabal has just screamed at David's men, and he refers to, and so this young man, this servant, refers to him as a worthless man in verse 17. We've seen the word before. It actually is the word Belial. You know, so he's a son of Belial, a wicked man. It's actually the same name used for Eli's sons earlier in the book. Wicked, evil. The protection of David and his men has been like living behind the wall of a fortress day and night, this young man says. Safe, flourishing, and David's keeping. So, Abigail, consider what you should do. A storm is coming. It's headed right for us. David is about to open a can, and it's not spinach. Nabal is about to get what he deserves. Do you feel the tension rising in the story? Didn't something similar happen last chapter? David had an opportunity to kill King Saul, but instead of killing him, he entrusted justice into the hands of God. In fact, that's like the main thrust, the main idea of David's sermon to Saul and his men. David, have you forgotten your own sermon from like a couple days ago? So we've seen David's foolish problem in verses 1 through 17. Now let's keep going. Let's see Abigail's peaceful plan in verses 18 through 31. Look at verse 18. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I come after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God, do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him." Stop there. Abigail knows that Nabal's foolishness has put the entire house of Nabal in danger of being wiped out. So what does she do? Fire up the grills. Get the delivery driver, call up the delivery driver, call up ancient Uber Eats. Abigail delivers a piecemeal fit for an army, right? She has a servant deliver 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, which is estimated about 20 to 24 liters of wine, 5 already prepared sheep, 5 seahs of grain, roughly 35 quarts each, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and a partridge and a pear tree. If Nabal won't feed David's men, Abigail will. Abigail is sending a meal intended to establish peace, a meal meant to stop the wrath of a hangry king-to-be and his army. And look what she does in verse 20. And she rode on a donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain. Behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. She rides out to meet the army. This is Nabal's job. He's the one who's supposed to defend his house. Culturally, this is incredibly shameful on Nabal's account. But isn't this what Saul does too? Remember, Nabal is actually Saul's replacement in this story. He sends others to do his jobs, small shepherd boys to kill Goliath. Abigail is such a picture of boldness and honor in this section. What courage this woman, this beautiful, wise woman, is displaying. Abigail is courageously confronting an entire army at risk of her death. She's courageously confronting this army with hospitality and peace. It begs the question, I want to make this statement. Her hospitality is such a weapon of grace, more powerful than the sword. Isn't that interesting, the way that hospitality is pictured in this story? Hospitality is a weapon of grace, more powerful than the sword, bringing peace. Begs the question, what is your weapon of grace, hospitality, doing to advance God's kingdom in your home and at your dinner table? Though the meal has already arrived, David is still determined to wipe his shame off the map. Look what he says in verses 21 through 22. Now David had said, "Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God's do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belongs to him." So, the meal's already been delivered. So what's David still focused on? The little phrase, "He has returned me evil for good." Where have we heard these words in the immediate context? Well, peek back at 24 verse 17. 24:17, he said to David, this is Saul talking, you are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. Nabal is standing in the place of Saul. Nabal is like Saul. Nabal is not God's anointed. He's a nobody who deserves death for his foolishness and shame. Then Abigail speaks. I want you to notice the amount of real estate her speech takes up in this passage. 23 all the way down to 31. Now you got speeches throughout. You got David saying something, Nabal saying something, the servant saying something. There's like little snippets. But Abigail's speech takes up the majority of this section. Why? Because that's the focus of this passage. Abigail speaks. Look at verse 23. Here's what she says. Well, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She starts with humility. Her posture is like David's in 24:8. She bows. In fact, as she speaks, she refers to David as her small L, Lord, 14 times, and herself as a servant, 6 times in her peace plea. But then look what she says, her first words. On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Her first words are to take on the guilt of her foolish husband. She takes Nabal's guilt on herself, but she also doesn't let him get off scot-free. Nabal is a man of Belial, an evil man, and she calls him that. Calls him by his name, fool. There, a worthless man, man of Belial in verse 25, and then a fool in the same section, actually in the same verse, 25. She takes Nabal's name. Nabal is a man of Belial, an evil man, and she calls him that, a fool. But look where she points David's attention in verse number 26. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord, Yahweh, lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, those two things, blood guilt, saving with your own hand. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as the fool. She points David's attention back to the Lord, to Yahweh. The Lord has restrained or kept David from two things, shedding blood that isn't his to shed, and from seeking to save by his own hand. David, you can't save yourself. Only God can do that. She asks David to forgive based on the fact that God is going to establish David's house, verse 28, please forgive the trespasses of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. God will keep his promises, David. And verse 29, the Lord will bind you in the bundle or pouch of the living and care for you. These are shepherd's terms. A lot, oftentimes a shepherd would have a pouch, and in it would be stones that would actually be used to count sheep. That's how they work through some of that stuff. So what's happening here is the Lord will bind you in the bundle or pouch of the living and care for you. Those are shepherding terms. The Lord's going to keep you safe in his pouch. Excuse me. But look what she says in verse 29. In the lives of your enemies, he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. She's also providing an allusion to David's defeat of Goliath. The Lord will sling out your enemies like a stone. But look how she finishes her peace plea. She rounds it off with another reference to shed blood and saving with his own hand. Look at verse 31. My Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation with himself. She's actually talking about the time when David becomes the king. And she says, This time is a reference to sin's future consequences. When you become a king, you won't look back and see this time with guilt and consequences. She's saying that when he's old, he won't look back with shame for shedding blood and seeking to save himself. God has sent Abigail, this humble servant, to prevent David both from sin and its penalty in his life. You seeing any gospel connections? Well, we've seen David's foolish problem, and we've seen Abigail's peace plan, but how will David respond? This is kind of the tension of the story. It's like the climax of the story. What is going to happen? We saw in Saul's life, when he gets confronted, what does he do? Well, he tries to pin Jonathan to the wall with his spear, right? So should we expect David to be like Saul in his leadership? How will David respond? Look at David's response in verses 32 through 35. David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who, don't miss this, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried to come and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male left." David responds immediately with a threefold blessing. He blesses the Lord, the God of Israel. Why? Because Yahweh sent Abigail. Yahweh sent Abigail to meet him and to keep David from sin and its penalty. And then notice the word "kept" in verse 33 and the word "restrained" in verse 34. Two have been saved by God in this story, actually. To have been saved by God, sending this servant Abigail. Abigail has been the means by which God has not only saved Nabal's life and his entire house, at least for the moment, but Abigail has also been the means of saving David from sin and its future consequences. So what does David do? David sends her home in wholeness, peace, shalom. Abigail gives us a beautiful picture of Jesus in this episode. She intercedes between a foolish man who deserves death and the anointed king whose wrath is falling on the fool. Not only does she intercede for her husband, but how does she establish peace in this relationship? Through a meal that points us directly to the cross. What are the elements of the meal? The meal is comprised of a lamb that has been prepared. 5 sheep. Bread and grain, dried grapes and figs, and wine, fruit of the vine. Does this sound familiar? We eat a similar meal every single week. Except we don't eat one of those elements, lamb. Ever thought about that? Why don't we eat lamb at the Lord's Supper? We only eat bread and drink wine. That's because Jesus was the final atoning sacrifice. No other lamb needs to die. Jesus was the perfect lamb. Now we eat the bread, a symbol of life, as Jesus is the bread of life, and we drink the wine, a symbol of celebration. The meal we eat together in the Lord's Supper is a meal that symbolizes peace between God and man. It is a covenantal meal, a meal of a relationship reestablished through the blood of the Lamb. What an awesome picture we get here of Abigail. Like Abigail, Jesus intercedes for us as our advocate before the throne of God. Jesus, look at what were her first words. "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt." Jesus took our guilt and shame on himself. And the wrath of God that we deserved was poured out on him so that we might be saved and have a relationship with peace, a peace, just like what we see in verse 35. Peace. Peace. But that peace isn't for everyone. God's justice is about to fall on foolish Nabal. In this last section, God will solve Abigail's foolish problem. Look at verses 36 through 37. Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. He doesn't know how much his life is on the line, and what's he doing? Let's feast! What an idiot! And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and it became like a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Abigail returns home, but finds her husband sloshed and partying like a king. Because Nabal is very drunk, she doesn't tell him about what happened with David. She doesn't want to waste her words on her husband's foolish ears when her foolish husband is even more foolish than normal. So in the morning, when Nabal is awake and probably has a pounding hangover, she tells him the whole story. When he hears what happened, what happened? His heart dies within him. Ugh. And he becomes like a stone. Kind of comical. I think it's pretty funny. The stone Abigail referred to in verse 29, he becomes like a stone. The stone that Abigail referred to in verse 29 as being slung out by the Lord. And 10 days later, the Lord strikes Nabal dead. God has brought a swift end to the fool. But look what happens next in verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal and has kept back," there you go again, "kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." David sends to take Abigail, his wife, as his wife in the next verse. Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail in Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her head to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. So, what happens next in verse 39? David sends to take Abigail as his wife. Abigail humbly and excitedly accepts the offer of marriage, and they all lived happily ever after, right? Nope. The final two verses speak of David now technically having three wives, right? David, didn't God say in Deuteronomy 17:17, when he's speaking of kings, that kings are not supposed to multiply wives lest they steal your heart from the Lord? And David, I've heard those words, take, 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 before, from Samuel's mouth, referring to the king who will take everything. Kings, take. Are you taking another man's wife after his death? I hope this doesn't become a pattern where you take another man's wife and kill the husband. Seeds planted here flower and show fruit in 2 Samuel 11. As we look back at the passage, I want to zoom out and see how chapters 24, 25, and 26 connect, because it helps us to see more clearly the main idea the author is getting at. Remember, I haven't shared the main idea with you. What do you think it is? Remember, foolish Nabal is standing in for Saul in this episode. And there are two deaths in this episode, remember? Samuel and Nabal. The peaceful death of Samuel, mournful, the whole nation mourns him, and the chaotic, stony death of Nabal. So what should we expect if Nabal is actually standing in the place as an understudy of Saul? You see what's happening here? We should expect a chaotic, shameful death to come for Saul. That's exactly what we'll see at the end of 1 Samuel. And it won't come by David's hand, it'll come by God and his justice. Saul, at the end of 1 Samuel, shamefully tries to commit suicide by falling on his own sword, but he's incompetent even at that. So, as he lay there bleeding out, we find in 2 Samuel 1 that he asks a little boy passing by to finish him off. When the Philistines find his dead body, they strip him of his royal garments and armor, a sign of shame. They behead him. They hang his beheaded and naked body on the wall of their city, a picture of utter shame. And his men valiantly rescue his body from the wall and his sons. And then what do they do? They burn it, and then they bury his bones under that tree over there. It's as if Saul is dying every type of shameful death. Suicide, sword, shamefully stripped naked, beheaded, hanged on a wall for all to see, burned, and then buried under that tree over there like a dog. Saul suffers the just wrath of God for his utter foolishness. But in contrast, David will be a ruler unlike Saul. He will rule under God's authority. Whatever God says, he will do. But he's not perfect. He will make mistakes. But more than that, chapter 25 teaches us that unlike Saul, God will keep David from sin and its penalty. He'll preserve David. He'll preserve David's authority, shepherd him along the way. David will obey and God will keep him. And that's the main idea of the episode, as you see the theme again and again and again. You find it in Abigail's words twice. You find it in David's words. And you find it again in David's words. What's the main idea? God saves his people from sin and its penalty by sending his beloved servant. Now, there are three instances in the entire New Testament when God the Father speaks. You probably think of them off the top of your head. Baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist, Transfiguration, and there's one in John. But the two main ones are the baptism and the Transfiguration. How does the Father refer to the Son in that passage? You are my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. All of them emphasize the glory of the Son. But you are my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Remember the meaning of Abigail's name? Beloved of the Father. Abigail points our attention to the glorious Son sent by the Father to pay the price for our sins. To take our shame and our guilt, and he will offer his life an atoning sacrifice for the sin of those who deserve it. And what is the Father's exhortation on the Mount of Transfiguration? It's the exhortation for us today. Listen to the words of Jesus and be saved. You see where that places you and me in this episode? With which character do we identify? Is it David? No, he's the one bringing the wrath. Who's the one marked by foolishness, evil, and death? The one on whom the king's wrath is pointed. It's actually Nabal. Once again, you and I don't identify with David in this episode. Rather, you and I are Nabal. And God sent Abigail, whose name is Beloved of the Father, to intercede for the ones who deserved death, you and me. But unless you turn and find refuge in the beloved of the Father, you too will suffer the same fate as Nabal. The wrath of God will fall on you. Remember how the Father refers to the Son at Jesus' baptism and the transfiguration. Jesus is the beloved of the Father sent to save. We cannot save ourselves with our own hand, but Jesus is the one who must save. It is through Jesus that peace is established between God and man, and we celebrate a meal sent by the beloved of the Father every time we gather as Christians. But what about the ones who do not listen to or trust in the beloved of the Father, Abigail? Jesus? Death, eternal death and hell for all of eternity. Nabal the fool is even now burning right now as we speak in hell for rejecting God's king and not trusting in the king to come. So if you are to be at peace with the king of heaven, you must turn from your sin and foolishness and trust in Jesus to be saved. A Christian, the beloved of the Father not only came, I'm going to wrap this up, not only came to save us from the penalty of our sin, but to save us from continuing in our sin. So when Jesus saves you, he gives you his Spirit to help you stop sinning. He equips you with the victory of Jesus. Friend, this whole story doesn't point our attention to be more like David. It points our attention to David's greater son, Jesus, the beloved of the Father. Listen to him and be saved. Let's pray.